Okie dokie. Good evening, everyone. Is there any station out there with emergency or priority traffic? Good answer. Okay. Good evening, everyone. The Bergen Amateur Radio Association, Thursday Night Technical Net. This is a conversation with your radio, electronics, telecommunications, computers, the electrical forces of nature, things that operate on them, with them, by them, used by them, pretty much anything you want to talk about, as long as you can kind of provide some remote reason for why you should be talking about it on an amateur radio net. The format of this net is a little different than most. Part of the format is to have a discussion. And in order to do that, we actually need participants. You need not check in if you're a mushroom, but you need to check in if you're a licensed radio amateur and you can hear this station. We'd really like you to check in to participate in the conversation. If you have a question, a comment, or are, as I said, just out there listening, please check in, because your presence may help us hear the conversation in a way that would, A, be more pleasing to you, be more informative to you, in fact, maybe more pleasing and informative to others, because we might involve you even if you did not think you had a question or a comment, because we might ask for your opinion. And if not your opinion, your experience, which is even more valuable. So, we check into this net a little differently than others. We check in by call sign group in some reasonably logical order, which I'll go through in a minute, with your call sign, your name, and then you indicate whether you have a question, a comment, both, or none of the above. And that's pretty much how we start this. We'll collect it all by call sign group or subgroup, and then once we have that list, we will get on with the business at hand. We also will have a check-in on the EchoLink at some point. So if you're on EchoLink, don't worry. I have not forgotten to get you. Just waiting for the computer to boot up as we speak. So with no further ado, K2s with your call sign, your name, and indicate whether you have a question, comment, both, or none of the above, please call K2BAR. Okay, K2BAR, K2ZO. I think I have two questions, and no other comments at this time. Back to net. Okay, very good. Any other kilo twos? Okay, let's try W twos.
W2JEK, Don, no questions or comments.
Gotcha, Don. Good evening. A little crackly, but you're good. Any other whiskey twos?
WE2R, Charlie, no questions or comments.
Gotcha, Charlie. Very good. Who doubled with Charlie?
W2CH, good evening. Gordon Ray, none of the above.
Good evening, Ray. Nice seeing you last Saturday. Make some comments about that as well. Alrighty. Alrighty. Let's see. How about we go and clean out... Well, let's do the N2s first, and then I'll explain what I'm doing in a minute, just to for shaking it up a little bit. Any N2s?
This is N2OEL, three questions.
Oh, goody, goody. Excellent, Noel. Excellent. Any other November 2s? Okay, any Alpha calls?
WA2 qualify?
No, I was going to go back to the prefixed ones later. Okay. Any call signs beginning with whiskey, any format, any flavor, please call K2BAR.
To VAR, WA2CAI, no questions, no comments, no emergency traffic, and barely here.
Ah, come on, Tom, you sounded perkier 5 minutes ago than you do now. God bless you. All right, very good. Thank you for checking in. And no rate F2, right? Grin, grin. All right, any other whiskeys, any format?
Something you want to use, Bill? No questions, no comments.
Good evening, Bill. Very good. Any other whiskeys? Okay, any kilos, any format?
C2NKU, Maryland, no questions, no comments. Just the YL of W2CH. Good evening, everybody.
Hi, Marilyn. Nice seeing you again last Saturday. Thank you again for coming to the Ham Fest. Any other kilos?
In here. Take care.
All right. Any station on the radio side at this time, please call K2BAR. Yeah, just bear with me, folks. I'm just bringing up the echo link. Take me an extra second to do that. Just bear with me. Was there another station in there wanting to check in?
Yeah, K2ALI. Just testing to see if it works, and it does, so I'm checking in. No questions and no comments yet.
Good evening, Tony. Well, tonight we got questions. No problem about that. Very, very good. What the hell's going on here? Alrighty, maybe that'll work now. Alrighty, so before I get too crazed here, let's see, is there anybody on Echolink? Please call K2BAR.
K2BAR. Good evening, Gordon. Good evening, Danette. This is Kilo Delta 2, Alpha Kilo Papa. My name is Nestor, San Diego, California. No questions or comment at this moment. Thank you.
Connected, W2TTT.
Nestor, that's awesome. Greetings from northern New Jersey. That's excellent. Thank you for being our DX contact of the day. I had some Europeans check in, but that's good. KD2AKP, welcome aboard. Alrighty, would anybody else want to check in before we start with the questions? K2ZO, tag, you're it. K2BAR.
Okay, K2BAR. That's K2ZO. I have two questions. I was looking at the QST, and it shows the ad for the new fancy 5000 series Yaesu transceiver. And of course, it's got a couple of different versions, as Yaesu always does. They confuse the issue by too many offerings, I think. But anyway, they've got a 5000D, a 5000M, whatever, and a few other things. And one of the things that they have, of course, is a TCXO. Everybody knows a TCXO is a temperature-controlled transistor oscillator, which is a reference. I have one in my TS-2000. I also have one in my TS-480 and my 7600. So that's no problem. However, in one of the radios in the 5000 series, instead of a TCXO, they have an OCXO. Does anybody know what that is?
No, I don't. Does anybody else?
Take a look at the last page in QST this month. You'll see what I'm talking about.
Have you Googled the phrase?
I do, JEK.
Good, Don.
Yeah, it must be better than the TCXL because I'm reading the, it says 0.05 ppm OCXO included, and the other TCXLs is point plus or minus a 0.5, so it's a heck of a lot more stable.
I saw that, but what is it, and how does it work?
What's the obvious difference in the radio?
More buttons.
More buttons on this version with the OCXL. By any chance, I don't have the QST in front of me, but and you're referring to the September QST at this point?
The one we just got in the mail the other day. Mine's in the other room, yeah. But and Don is, of course, right that the whatever the OCXO is, it is apparently more stable than the TCXO. So as you pay more money, you can move on up in their 5000 series. So I have no idea what an OCXO, unless it's optically controlled. I don't know. Perhaps it's linked to a satellite somewhere. It doesn't make sense. It's not explained.
Hello,
yeah. Go ahead.
Oven-controlled crystal oscillator.
Okay. I thought that the TCXO was oven control. Oh, perhaps it's not. It's just temperature control. Okay, the other one has an oven in it. Okay, I think you hit it.
That would make sense. That certainly would make sense. And where did you come up with that out of your hat, Mr. Noel?
Wikipedia. An oscillator of this type is known as an oven-controlled crystal left paren OCXO, where XO is an old acronym for crystal oscillator. This type of oscillator uses the temperature control chamber to maintain a quartz crystal and an electronic crystal oscillator at a constant temperature in order to prevent changes in the frequency due to variations in ambient temperature. It achieves the highest frequency stability possible with a crystal.
Atomic property would use the letter O. That's where I was going with it.
Gentlemen, you WW2CH.
I apologize. Who is that? Go ahead.
W2CH, Ray. I just want to say you doubled most of it, although Noel came through most of it.
Then you know what? I'm not going to burden everybody with hearing. You know, if Noel got through, then I'll leave it to be. I was just saying that it's amusing that I was struggling to figure out what atomic property or what external reference source would use the letter O. Go ahead, Noel, if you want to say anything else.
No, it appears that the high gain antenna at 55 watts won on the last phone.
Well, my 2-meter Yagi is horizontal and it's pointed east, or northeast, actually, so I'm not exactly hot on the repeater. If I was on the vertical, it would probably have been a fairer fight, but much to everybody's happiness, you won. And I'm glad. Alrighty. Any more on this topic?
Just one last comment. What we used to have as temperature-controlled crystal oscillators, which used ovens in our old Motorola radios, if you remember, were referred to at that time as TCXOs. So now we've moved on to something else. Okay, that makes sense. Oven-controlled crystal oscillator. Never thought of it. I just assume that they all spill into that TCXO field.
Well, the difference, Jim, is that there has to be a heating element for an oven-controlled crystal oscillator, whereas you could have just a thermally stabilized environment, i.e. without additive heat, in the temperature control. W1AU. Go ahead, Bill.
There's one other difference, and it's a big one, and that is the cut of the crystal. The cut in the crystal for an oven is not stable at all at room temperature, but once it's at temperature, it's rock solid, where a TCXO is just a complicated system whereby it figures, you know, the designer figures out the drift for a particular cut of the crystal and then compensates for that for the normal range of the radio. W1AU.
Ah, so the cut of the crystal matters.
Yep, but that still doesn't make it possible for me to guess what the OCXO was.
Oh, very good. Anybody else? Okay. Alrighty. Jim, your next topic?
Okay. Just sitting here doing some thinking about a new computer. This one's getting a little bit old. I think it's about 12, 14 years old. And it's about time we went to Windows 7 and all that good stuff. So I'm sitting here kind of making a list of what I want. I definitely do not want a motherboard with a sound card on it. And I don't want one with a video card on it. Because I know I'll be using a more high-end version of both. However, I have a question. You know, there is another product that is out there, which is a external sound card made by Signalink. And the question I have is, if you use one of those, does that take the place of the full sound card? In other words, do I need to buy another sound card? Back to that.
Okay. For the purpose of radio interfacing, no. For purposes of, shall we say, audio processing, for, you know, on a more sophisticated basis, yes.
Okay, so that basically is it. It is so then you end up really with two sound cards, and then you run into problems of selecting one from the other and how you do that, and that's that was what I'm thinking of and trying to avoid that. That way you would just have one sound card, but I guess it's not going to work.
You should seek to avoid that. I think that's something you might consider actually an advantage or and welcome. But personal opinion, but different things. Are you thinking about getting a software-defined radio?
Well, I already have a receiver, a software-defined receiver. Which I'm going to tie in and use into the IF of my other radio. So that's where that's now. But I do need a new computer.
Well, you're a popular guy tonight. Well, I think you're going to find that getting a high-performance radio, getting a high-performance audio for DSP purposes, as opposed to convenience of operation, like what that, you know, interface provides, you know, are really two different kinds of ham radio interfacing, and nothing wrong with that. You know, I think that it's an excellent product. If I had to start all over again, I would give it great consideration. I kind of went down the Rig Blaster route, but, you know, if I were thinking about it, I'd probably go that route. If you're doing high-end DSP, you want something with like 192 kilohertz of bandwidth capability, and there's some really nice external sound cards that you can find out there that connect either on USB or FireWire. So I think it's something to give great consideration to. Anybody else have comments?
And to OEO.
Go ahead, Noel.
This show, Jim Jackson bought a Flex radio, and I asked him some questions about it, saying if I bought a computer to match, for instance, the Flex 3000, what kind of sound card would it need? He said it doesn't matter, because the sound card is only going to do your audio out, what you're listening to. On the modern Flex radios, everything is done within the box. And it comes over on the FireWire card. So you'd only have to worry about the sound card if you were doing one of the little kits that uses your sound card in the computer to demodulate and select the frequency, of which in that case you'd want 192 for the widest range of bandwidth that you can see on the monitor at any one time. Next message.
You know, you're right, and I did misspeak a little bit. So the current Flex family of radios, the 1500, 3000, and the 5000, the first two use USB and have 50 and 100 kilohertz of bandwidth each. The 5000 has 192 kilohertz per receiver, and if you add the second receiver, you get two, but it uses a FireWire interface. So, and they recommend a specific FireWire interface, and they definitely recommend a high-end cable if you're going to use that. But if you're going to interface, let's say, your 7600, Jim, I think that interface that you talked about would be just fine to interface that to the radio. And if later on you wanted to, you know, use your SDR, I think, find ways of doing that. From a CPU and all other good viewpoint, I think that same platform could be adapted later if you're ever to buy a 1500, a 3000, or a 5000. So I was thinking more of the 1000 series. That was silly me, and some other platforms that require an analog input. They don't integrate it very well. So I apologize for that confusion. So, you could buy that interface and a FireWire interface for that and the USB interface. The audio interface... Let me finish that. The audio interface would just be for sound. And it wouldn't be that confusing with the, you know, when you compare it to, let's say, the interface you're talking about to interface your 7600 to your... a new computer. But, you know, some people just like good sound coming out for sound's sake, and that would be your speakers and things like that. So, you know, you get something nice. You have to go crazy. It probably could be, you know, something that you plug into the cart. It would be just fine. I think the thing to consider is, you know, as much memory as you can stuff on it, like on the order of 8 gig, you know, a couple of hard, you know, a hard drive, some sort of CD, DVD, you know, Blu-ray, whatever kind of drive. And I would consider getting video cards that allow you to put in 2, 3, or 4 monitors, so that you can have them for different things. So, you know, a modern computer can drive, especially with the modern video cards, they can drive two very nicely, and a lot of them allow you to stack cards so you can drive 3 or 4 if you want. I did that with an older machine a few years ago, and it was marvelous. Anybody else for Jim and his question, please call K2BAR.
Yeah, that's okay.
I've added you to the list. Do you have a comment, Mr. Jim?
Yeah, right. Anyway, the 3000, 5000 are both FireWire, and only the 1500 is USB. And, of course, the old 1000 required audio. It merely takes a moderately powerful computer that you can tune so that... the DPCs are low. It doesn't take huge horsepower, but it takes a well-architected machine, which a lot of the machines that you can buy over-the-counter are frequently not well-architected. They're okay. They do, you know, office and they do whatever, but as far as trying to get them to run without interruption, like in this case you're using it as a DSP, they're not quite so great. NS2K, back to NAP.
So what would you recommend? Some sort of high-end quad-core processor?
No, it doesn't have to be all that. It doesn't even necessarily have to be quad core. Dual core would certainly be desirable, but quad core would be nice. Memory 64. If you're of course with Flex, it's got to be under a Windows operating system. Could be XP, could be 7. The only way you can get all that extra memory to run is running the 64-bit versions. A non-shared memory video display is probably quite desirable. Also, the FireWire interface, you want to read the readmes in Flex, as there are a lot of them that are really kind of half-baked, and you need to avoid those.
Yeah, I'll attest to that. And the good news is I have a recommended card, very good. One thing I would say is that if you can run an amazing amount of stuff if you have the horsepower. Jim's life cycle for a computer is about a decade or more, so I'm thinking that, you know, more is better at this point. My one question in retort to what you said, Mr. NS2K Jim, you mentioned the 64-bit version. Does that limit you in what you can do? Aren't there some programs that just won't run in 64-bit mode? What's your practical step forward for now?
884WD.
Go for it.
Go ahead, Rachel.
If you're getting Windows 7 Ultimate 64-bit, it has a 32-bit compatibility mode, which also allows you to run XP software. So you're much better off, going up one level with the operating system. And I'm using Ultimate, and I'm having no problems running any of the 32-bit applications, even the XP applications, on a laptop.
That's a bit. Good. Excellent, Rachel. Thank you. So Windows Ultimate, Windows 7 Ultimate should be your game, and since Windows 8 is lurking in the fields, ready to crawl out of the ground, it's probably a good strategy, Jim. K2ZO, K2BAR.
W2CH comment.
Ed Ray.
Yes, Gordon. I have Windows 7 since it came out. I upgraded from Ultimate Home, whatever it was, to Professional, and I run Virtual XP so I can run older programs. And I have a starter netbook, Toshiba, also that's lets me run the 32-bit, while the Professional, of course, with that computer is 64-bit, but also lets you do the older, as Rachel said there. With Professional was the upgrade I went to in my case, or as she said, I just thought I'd comment my experience.
Very good. Very good. That's helpful. Anybody else?
Comment?
Rachel.
He's talking about premium, home premium, and you can upgrade the premium to Professional, and then you can upgrade Professional to Ultimate. And yes, Professional did have a downloadable driver or downloadable component that gave you the 32-bit. I don't know if that's still available. That was something that they came out with at the initial offering.
Let me just steer the question a little bit differently. If I was going to run Windows 7, I'm hearing Professional, Ultimate, and possibly, let's just say I'm going to run Ultimate. Well, I'll make that judgment call, whatever hundreds of dollars that is. If I choose to, what hardware platform you know, let's talk about this in I mean, Jim made a good comment about the video, that it should not, it should use non-shared memory, i.e. it should have its own memory on the video card. I get that, and that's the characteristic which I can pay attention to. We go back to video and audio cards in a minute, and maybe even FireWire, although I think you addressed that too, where to go for that, using the Flex reference notes. But what CPU and how much memory should one plan on putting in there? And when you have this, frankly, ballsy platform, and I'm not looking for a minimum, I'm just looking for where is the price performance curve? You know, toward the high end of the price performance curve, but not, you know, in the, what I'll call the silly range. Where is that? What does it cost for a CPU board with how much memory? What kind of processor should it have? And then we'll ask about disk drives. So, and what kind of memory should it be? You know, what processor with what kind of memory? And how much of it? Maybe that we should start there. It was an open-ended question only in respect to who can respond. Who wants to respond to that?
HA4WD.
Okay, Rachel.
Today, a lot of the software licensing goes by processor, and so 4 cores, of course, is going to be better. You have the ability in the bootstrap to shut off some of those cores if you had to. Some programs do not work very well with multi-core processors. And again, it depends on the architecture. If it's AMD versus Intel, they have two different architectures, one dealing with the core and how they access memory. So you really need to understand what applications you're going to be running, and how they're going to be running, and how they are going to interact with the architecture to really give a good answer. If you're looking at just general in use, comments before, 2-core versus 4-core really doesn't matter. If you're, you know, just running an office or an open source type of office product, when you're starting to get into the more unique things like CAD-CAM software, CAE software, and Flex software, that's where you have to really be cautious with regard to which architecture you're going with. Back to that.
Flex really care how many processors it's running on?
Windows 7 is doing a good job of balancing between processors. It's looking to see which one has something assigned to it, and then the next program that starts gets assigned to the processor that is with a lower load or an idle processor, so that all of them will be running in parallel. The concern is if they're going to interact with each other.
JK. Go ahead, Don.
I'm looking at an ad in here in the QRP quarterly that by Flex Radio Systems advertising the Flex 1500. And it says Flex 15 operation requires connection to a PC running Windows XP, Vista, or Windows 7.
Right. I understand that. But Jim started, you know, raised the subject with the with the notion that his last computer that he has currently was bought a dozen years ago. So trying to project what would be a significantly, you know, substantial processor a decade out. Now, let me just give you, calibrate my brain here for a second. I'm using a CF29 Series 3 and a Series 2, and they are basically steroidal netbooks with some armor around them. I mean, that's what they are from a current model kind of configuration. If you buy a 1 gig processor netbook with a gig and a half, 2 gig of memory, that's pretty much what's in my toughbook. That design is almost 10 years old, and it's still running just fine. It runs XP just fine with a gig and a quarter and a gig and a half, respectively, in the two machines. So, do I have to be in 10 years from now that I'll still be running them? Probably not, except it would, in very narrow ways, if I still have them at all. So, you know, but I've had these for pushing 7 years now. Myself and the design, as I say, is about 10 years old. So, I'm trying to kind of push that performance envelope to, you know, project forward for this desktop environment that we're talking about. Mr. K2Zeta, why don't you calibrate us?
I can't calibrate anybody. I'm still confused. I had enough trouble when I built my first 8080 computer and didn't have anybody to help me. It took me a year to get that going.
That's because you bought an 8080 when there were still solid D80 performers out there.
I just bought a chip and then played with it. That's what I did.
I'm sorry. I heard 8080 and processed 8086. I am sorry. Yes, okay. So you processed an Intel, you got an Intel processor when it was a perfectly good Z80 out there. It's a little different. I always felt sorry for the people who bought the original IBM PCs. I said, wow, all that expense, all that iron, so little value. the DRS-80, especially, or my CPM machine, or my MPM machine, could kick its tail 6 ways from Sunday. But anyway, at one point I had a Z800 machine. But anyway, that's enough of that. So, a dual core processor running Windows 7 Ultimate with as much power as possible, and run it in 64-bit mode with the compatibility mode to 32. And what do you figure, guys? I'm gonna pull Rachel, Jim, NS2K, and anybody who wants to follow. How much RAM would you put into that? And I guess speed will be a function of, assuming it's a dual core machine, speed will be a function of wallet more than anything. So how much RAM, and if you can, how fast should the processor be? Rachel first. AJ4WD, K2BAR.
AJ4WD.
Okay, so how much RAM and what, and how fast a processor? Rachel?
I'm sorry, I'm trying to navigate here in traffic.
All right, we'll skip you. Not a problem. Jim and Mr. K?
Depends on what you're trying to do. The Flex software will run on probably a dual core with standard 32-bit mode, you know, what, 2 gigs of RAM, whatever. The trick comes when you want to run all that other stuff at the same time. You're, you know, say, logging software, your other digital modes, decoding, and all that other stuff, that's, some of which is very processor intensive and some of it not. And, it depends on how much you want to do on that. One of the comments that I'll make is, the Macintoshers actually make pretty good PCs, although I'm not sure right at the moment how stable Lion is running in the boot camp mode. It was working pretty well with Snow Leopard, but the newer ones oftentimes cannot even be downgraded to Snow Leopard, and I think there are birthing problems with Lion running that mode. In any case, they make pretty good PCs, and they actually have good FireWire interfaces. In any case, I don't know, you almost have to try it, and actually look at the Abrams, what's the guy's name, who sells stuff semi through these reference to on the Flex site. He has a prices of each one. So that could actually be a pretty good place to look for, you know, a well-practiced, a person who really has built a lot of these systems.
Okay, and that would be a good baseline. What I was getting at was you listed out a bunch of things, and I was thinking even DM780 by name, in addition to everything else, and all the other things, and yeah, that's what I want to run simultaneously. So when you think of, well, if you did this, and if you did this, and if you did this, yeah, the answer to that is yes. So, because I'm trying to give headroom to future growth. So, anybody else?
This is W2JC with a comment, sir.
Go, Jim.
Generally, I suggest people get as much RAM as they can afford, up to whatever the operating system limit is, and the fast speed they can afford, because you're going to want it. Eventually, you're going to want it or need it. And I second also the memory on the video board. Most people don't realize that most of the cheap video boards steal memory from the RAM and also steal from the CPU. And one of the biggest problems I've found with computers bogging down has to do with the video processing. So definitely, if you can get a board with the video memory separate on the video board, it's much better. Over.
Yeah, not only that, but the video processing continues, whether or not the CPU is involved, which is even better. Once the video is on the video card, it stays there, and it does its magic, self-contained. So the CPU, essentially you have a video attached processor, and you're not sharing, you're not moving memory around from the common memory to the memory quite as wordily on the main bus. Only when you need to move it from the one to the other, you need to actually get involved in that. Yeah, anybody else? There's probably
connected KD0BDI connected KD2AKP.
So, 8 seems to be pretty normal. You might want an extensible above that, but again, as fast as you can. You want more slow memory. You want more fast memory, subject to your budget. So that's good. Standalone video card, supporting one or two, preferably two actually, displays to use them efficiently. If not, two video cards, each porting their own display, the like. But I gotta believe integration across cards is harder than integration within a card to two displays. So keep that in mind. What else? So I can think of for now. Anybody else have comments before I hand it back to Jim?
A2AMI with a sort of a comment.
Okay, Tony.
ARL sends down a weekly bulletin, and on that page, they show an advertisement on the right-hand side of an outfit called Lazy Dog. And Lazy Dog is now producing software-defined receivers and transceivers. I've never heard of Lazy Dog before, but obviously there are more people getting into this this market, and maybe even at a better price point. Some of the prices mentioned on the Lazy Dog site are in the $200 field for small transceivers. I don't know how good they are, but just you might look up Lazy Dog software-defined receivers and explore that also.
Most excellent. We'll certainly do that. Anybody else? Just checking the echoing to make sure that, no, I guess Nestor doesn't want to make a comment. I've been checking to see if he wants to jump in. He's going to text me if he wants to jump in. Alrighty, K2ZO, K2BAR.
Okay, K2BAR. That says K2ZO.
It's your topic to close, sir, or continue.
Well, I'm sitting here looking at kits here on Tiger Direct and Newegg and all these places, so I'm still scratching my head here because I don't know what all the abbreviations really mean. You know, it's been almost 12 years since I built my last computer, and things have changed quite a bit, but I'm learning. So thanks again. Back to that. This is K2ZO.
Well, as you continue on this saga, we want to hear more about your discovery as you board a decision, when you make a decision. Be all curious about that. My general advice is PC Magazine runs a good website, and some of the others do, comparing processors, and you might want to look at those, okay?
Okay, very good.
And every so often you'll see one of them actually compare motherboards, though they've been trying to move away from that in recent years, but you can see a discussion of processors, not so much motherboards, but certainly processors, and then you have to find an architecture on a board that actually optimizes the use of all the features of a given processor. You can have two boards. One doesn't make use of all the goodies that the processor has. Kind of a waste. Yeah, you can put this high-end processor here, but you're not going to get everything else you want out of it, which would be kind of a disappointment. But anyway. Alrighty. Any more for Jim before we move on?
8J4WD.
Cater Rachel.
K2BAR 8J4WD. I agree with what was said with regard to memory. You need to have a lot of memory and fast memory on that video processor card, because if you're having multiple screens, you have to have memory to represent each of those screens. And if it's some image that's going to be moving very quickly, like a waterfall or such, they're going to have multiple frames, if you would, that will overlay each other or get swapped out. So if you don't have enough memory on that video card, you may not be able to take advantage of all the video processing that's being done by that separate microcomputer. And that's also where the built-in video card starts to take over the system, because if you have a lot of activity going on, it's going to be doing a lot of memory pages to swap around for the video, and it could very easily eat up all of your system memory. Again, agreeing that you need to have as much system memory as warrants. Back to that.
Comment.
Treasure.
Yeah, the other thing is you don't want it being going around doing memory paging if you're trying to use it as a DSP or, you know, other decoder, you know, the 960 software or the SDR, because the computer basically stops for a moment while memory is being swapped in and out. So it's a really bad thing. NS2K.
Is they swapped in and out of the disk?
Exactly.
Yeah, you don't want that at all. That's why I was thinking 6 or 8 gig is probably okay, depending on how bizarro you get with what else you're doing. But, okay, very good. Anybody else?
Comment?
Hey, Rachel?
With large memory systems, you're having a similar type of issue within the memory itself, because the memory is being managed, and you can have, quote, swapping of memory chunks around also when it tries to optimize the free memory space. So that's another reason why you want to have sufficient memory in the box, so you're not swapping within memory. That's a lot faster swap, but nonetheless it's swapping and, you know, defragmenting, if you would, of your virtual memory space.
I'll be right there. Hold on.
KD0BVI disconnected.
Alrighty. Well, that was useful. Apparently, by the way, if you're looking for something like an easy up kind of thing, I haven't seen them, but my troops, former, what do you call it, former committee chair and now commissioner, just called and said Pathmark has easy ups for $40. In mind, we roll through the end of the summer. That actually might be something good to pick up for next year. Alrighty. Anybody have any follow-on comments to Rachel? Okie doke. Then, with your permission, Mr. Zetto, we will proceed.
By all means.
Okie doke. Yeah, I think a higher-end dual core may be more economical than a quad core of almost the same or even less performance, so that's something to think about. So, because at the end of the day, you can only run on one processor, unless it's written to run on multiple processors, whatever that application is. But that's an interesting thought. So keep that in mind as well. Alrighty, our next question comes from our good friend Mr. K, from N2OEL. Mr. Noel, go right ahead.
Thank you. First question, what would be a recommended logging software? I'm not into contesting now, but general purpose logging software.
I'm thinking DM780 and the whole HRD thing.
You mean Ham Radio Deluxe?
Yes, sir.
Yes, Gordon and Noel. I use N3FJP. You do have to pay for it, the whole suite. There's a disk with all the different contests and logging for $49 from N3FJP. And at WECA, we've been using it for the Link computers at Field Day, and I use it for the VHF contest.
If you're using FJP software, that is networkable, whereas, HRD is not. He was looking for general-purpose logging programs. Is FJP set up for general-purpose logging, or is he really just a contest package?
Well, it is geared a lot towards the contest, all the different types. You can buy certain ones, or like I said, the whole disk program with, they give you the key for each type, like, say, the VHF QSO parties or the 1010 contest or so. There is a logging program also, but of course there are a lot of other general logging. I haven't used them for a while. There was one called, I think, Logger 32.
Yeah, that's good. Let's take a little poll around here. Who uses what? So, let's see, Zetto, NS2K, HA4WD, W2JEK. Let's start with you, and then we'll go around to the rest of the group, what they're using. In that order, please.
I use the back of old envelopes.
And what, someone sends you a card, you send them a card back?
I don't think I've sent a QSL card in 25 years.
Making me feel good. And Mr. K. HA4WD.
Ham Radio Deluxe.
This is Rachel, at W2JDK.
W2JK, I use paper log.
WE2R?
Yeah, Gordon, I got distracted. What was the question?
What do you use to log, or what have you used to log?
Mostly I use my old ARRL logbook with a pen. And I've used a logging program in my PSK31 program, but it seems more trouble than it's worth. Easier to just write it down.
Okay, very good. CAI? Alpha Uniform?
Whenever I do the seminars, they have a whole bunch of pads for everybody. I scoff up on them and write them down. Strictly paper at the moment, but I'm transitioning, so I'm listening carefully. W1AU.
KE2NKU? K2AMI.
The only logging software I use is not for QSOing, it's for contesting, and that's, of course, the CT. And I kind of save the logs, that's all.
Okay, very good. Let's try this one. Nestor, we're going to drop it and let you come in. KD2AKP, what do you use to log, or what have you used to log? K2BAR.
KC2WWX disconnected.
It's interesting, I never saw that station connect. Nestor, the question is, what logging software do you use? What logging software do you use?
A logging software for what? I don't understand. For logging and where?
Your ham radio contacts, either general purpose logging or contest logging. What software do you use, if anything?
I actually should be ashamed of myself. I don't keep a log. I used to do it years ago, but it's been a while since being active in radio. So at the moment, I don't use any software. So that is your answer.
Yeah, I don't do general purpose logging. I'm terrible that way. So I understand. But I've used CT. I've used some of the inboard programs for PSK31, and occasionally I'll use HRD. But I'm not. I haven't settled on which computer I'm going to have as a shack computer for HRD. So I'm not so sure. But the W3FJP software, FPJ, whatever it is. Ray pointed out, it's got my interest all of a sudden. W2JC, what do you use to log?
This is W2JC. Well, funny you should ask. You know those value pack ads you get in the mail? Well, a lot of them have blank backs. So I use the blank back and a pen. And then I stick it in the appropriate page of my diary book. And that's my modernized version of logbook.
Boy, I think of all the people who paper log, Don's the only one who sounds like he's really, really together. He and Charlie. The rest of us sound like scallywags. Very good. Oh, that's funny. Okay, very good. So, Mr. Noel, back to you. And 2OEL, K2BAR.
Okay, the next one's an easy one. During a recent operating session in my motorhome, a little background, I've substituted for the 1141 and 1156 overhead lights. I've substituted LED lights that I bought on eBay. Now, there's finally found a couple that really gave me a decent amount of light. There were two of the same operating at the time, one over the operator's position, one over the stove where the SP220 was. During the period of 20 hours of operation, the LED lights over the stove sort of melted. In fact, the surface of the LEDs, some of them fell off the unit. There was, actually this particular one has 54 little tiny surface mount LEDs. Some of them turned black. Some of them, one side of the solder pad lifted up and they were just hanging there. And it caused a dead short eventually and blew the fuse. It was exciting. Question is, it was strange. Do you think it was the additional heat from the amplifier, the RF, or just bad luck?
Where were these things located? In the ceiling of your motorhome?
Yeah, approximately over the SP220.
I don't think it has anything to do with the SP220 unless they absolutely fell apart while you were operating. Is that what they did?
Melted the solder.
Yeah, I'm thinking just the temperature.
Yeah, but there's two identical ones. The one over the operator is unchanged.
Is it a hotter pocket due to, let's say, just normal solar exposure of the vehicle when parked and you're not using it?
Maybe the stove was on.
No, the stove was not because the amplifier was sitting on top of the stove. And this happened somewhere overnight.
Did you leave the amplifier on overnight?
Yes, it was busily being used, and the identical, and by the way, these are up at ceiling level, so you wouldn't think there would be that much difference because the heat would spread. The vent was on, steadily sucking air out, so you'd think there would be a slight breeze there. It's just strange that the other one, when I opened it up, it looked fine. This one, I brought it to the coffee the other time, and really quite impressive destruction that this LED light suffered. It was spectacular.
Okay, we're talking about made in China surface mount LED lighting, right?
Yeah, and there's 54 little SMDs mounted all around and on the end of the thing. It's meant to replace a tail light car, or I guess a backup light, made to replace like 1156 bulbs.
Before we run out of summer, on a similar day with a similar orientation to the sun, put down the amplifier, fire it up on a similar temperature day, take two thermometers at ceiling level, and I think you'll have your answer real quick. For that matter, do it without the amplifier and see if you'll notice. My guess is it's air circulation more than anything, not necessarily the local contact heat from the amplifier.
2AMI?
Can I tell you?
But what I hear from the well is that these were designed for taillight replacements, which is sort of limited duration operation, or even intermittent operation if they're involved with a signal direction or a stoplight. And he was running on a continuous thing. I don't think they were properly heat dissipated, designed, you know. Don't you think that this might be something that is not intended for continuous operation?
Well, their taillights are meant for continuous operation, but maybe in a uncontained space, or not as contained a space as the ceiling of a motorhome with the sun beating down on it.
Good day, okay.
Don?
Yeah, is there any kind of a ballast in this device that drops the 12 volts down to something that the LEDs can use?
I don't know. I gave it to Jerry at O2C to take apart.
Where's the LED?
Should we say logbook approach of, you know, recycled paper in the back of a diary book. He really likes that. Just thought I'd pass along that text for those who aren't on Echolink. All right. Well, that would be revealing to find out what his disassembly uncovers. But my guess is that, I mean, I'm not sure it's the amplifier per se, but it is just heat load near the ceiling. One side got warmer than the other, and that's that. It might be due to orientation, circulation of heat, air in the vehicle, and it could be due to the additional load on that side of the vehicle, heat load, due to the amplifier, but fascinating stuff. When you mounted it as an area light, did you take the lens off of it so that they were exposed, therefore they could be cooler?
No, I did not. And as an aside, 1156 light is the one that you'd normally use at a high intensity. You would normally use that in a running light that would be on continuously, or occasionally a backup light. You wouldn't use it in a stoplight because that would have two contacts on the bottom. We've used this often because we put it in at the beginning of the year's camping season, and we used it ourselves as much as 2 or 3 hours during a normal evening. You know, once it starts getting dark, this would be one of the lights because they use very little power. I think I'm drawing about 400 mils compared to, what is it, 1156, 1141 draws about 2.25 amps. Yeah, it's a lot less juice.
Western.
Gotcha.
What are the problems with the LEDs running on 12 volts? Is they're somewhat sensitive to voltage? Keep in mind you have sort of fixed voltage across the LEDs, and then you're dropping a small amount of voltage across the ballast resistor, which is attempting to keep them from running away. If the voltage is running high, like you're running a continuous charger, it's going to be high, and the current will be significantly higher than, say, if the charger were not operating and you were running straight off battery, voltage would be considerably lower. But also, other question is, are these the, I'll say, what kind of brand, what is the cheapness of the Chinese, how should I say, fixture both the fixture, because some of them don't dissipate heat very well, or the light bulb LED assembly itself.
All right, I have to take a cheap shot here. You had to ask that question? Noel bought it.
That's why I asked it.
Go ahead, Noel.
One thing, on the newer motorhome, they have a 12-volt supply that runs all of the appliances, similar to the one, the 45-amp supply that Jim Joyce bought a few months back. Very nicely regulated. It's a steady 13.8 volts or whatever. He showed it to us at the Baron meeting one time. This motorhome is 1992. It basically uses a big transformer that puts out an AC current that allegedly equals a 13.8 volt DC, allegedly. However, there is no regulation. It's a big transformer. There's nothing else in there. We were running the amp off of a Honda EU2000. We were running the motorhome off of a Honda EU3000, which puts out a steady 125.4 volts. There was very little load, except for a couple LED lights. I believe one fluorescent fixture that's 9 watts per tube, one fan that draws a couple amps, and on the 120-volt side, a transceiver. So what do we draw? 3 or 4 amps tops. So the Honda generator was probably putting out its full voltage, and it's probably it was a little bit on the hot side.
So it was, if it's running hot, the potential for putting a higher voltage on the LEDs is very much there, and that could be the root of your problem.
Also, your peaks are going to be there, where you wouldn't get a peak current flow on DC. However, they're two lights the same. That's the thing that was different. Ready for the next question.
Okay, just to close this up, there could be manufacturing quality differences. There could have been some local heat differences that were exacerbating the situation and pushing it over the edge. Your next question, sir.
Okay, I have Windows Vista currently on a quad-core 1.8 gig gateway computer. Got, I believe, 4 gig of RAM, and 500 gig hard drive, something like that. Anyways, I'd like to dual boot it to Windows 7 because it was included a free upgrade to Windows 7. Is there some software that's available to do that very simply, since I'm not very accomplished? Or should I, is there an easy way to do a dual boot?
Let me ask a question. Why in God's name do you want to stay with Vista if you have Windows 7 available?
Well, it's very simple. It works. I don't have to mess with it. I'm using this when I sit here and go on the web. And what I was thinking is Windows 7 with a stripped-down operating system where you get rid of most of your unimportant processes could be used, for instance, with a Flex 3000. So if you were going to use it for the radio, you'd boot to Windows 7. And for general, I'd look at email. I see a movie once in a while. It works very nicely. I have a rule. Don't mess with success.
AJ4WD.
Okay, I'm going to just suggest that upgrading to Windows 7 will not be a painful process. If you want to have dual boot and two, shall we say, configurations of the operating system, make one Windows 7 and make the other one Windows 7. But for God's sake, why torture yourself with two different operating system versions, which you don't need to do to facilitate anything other than, perhaps the configuration change you talked about. But, I would in a heartbeat upgrade your existing partition to Windows 7. Let's spin the dial and figure out who wants to comment about that. Either challenge me or challenge Noel's decision or viewpoint. K2BAR, who's first?
Comment.
Go ahead, Jim.
And that's okay. Associating Vista with success is really pushing it.
That was kind of where I was coming from. Anybody else? You could buy Vista at a point of sale, but POS stands for something else. I'll just leave it at that. I went back to XP pending Windows 7 because Vista was such an atrocity. Anybody else?
Comment?
Go ahead, Rage.
AJ4WD to net. Noel, the only way that you're going to have Vista and Windows 7 running on the same box is to have two separate partitions or two separate hard drives. and you can switch between the two, but again, why would you want to do that? If you're very familiar with Vista and the Vista operating system, it's a very easy migration over to Windows 7. Windows 7 has a much smaller footprint, both for disk space, memory space, and is much more efficient in the way that it runs and uses the processor. You're not going to be able to have both of them running on the same drive because the applications that would be on the drive would need to be re-registered with the registry of the two different operating systems, and they're not compatible.
Well, if I put two drives in, clone one to the other, everything's installed already, I upgrade one of them to Windows 7, and everything's already installed.
Let me try this. Everybody here is telling you, don't use Vista.
May be installed, but the operating system will not recognize it. It's going to ask you to reinstall. It's going to download a whole bunch of new DLLs and software to make it compatible with Windows 7, and then it won't work in your Vista.
Now, one partition, I mean, you will be so much happier with Windows 7 even with one partition.
Well, the reason I was thinking is I had looked online, and it seems that if you do Google search for dual boot Vista and Windows 7, it seems that you can do that without any additional software. If Vista was installed first, you would partition the hard disk and put Windows 7 on the second partition, or you'd put a different hard drive in and put Windows 7 on the second hard drive and use the Windows 7 bootloader. That's one way. The other way, you can buy a software program that'll do it. And the only reason is Windows 7 works. It satisfies the limited things that I do when I sit here working. And I didn't want to mess with success.
What did Jim say about success in Vista? You want to repeat it, Jim?
Success and Vista don't belong in the same sentence.
Thank you, Jim. Noel, you're leading a charmed life if you're considering it successful.
Comment W2CH.
Go ahead, Ray.
I believe maybe Rachel can add to that. If you want to partition a computer, used to have a problem with the Sony years ago that wanted to get rid of a partition the way it always came, C&D. There's a program, I don't know, the latest version called Partition Magic that lets you create or remove partitions.
But it doesn't let you extend them using newly created, does it?
When you're in the program, it lets you move the partition around to let you choose how much of that drive you want to give to each one.
Right, but once the partition's established, can you expand it?
Let's see. I'm not sure about that. I haven't used it for quite a while because I had Partition Magic version 7, then 8 for a Sony VAIO I don't have. And they used to always, even though it was only originally 10 gigabyte, and then I had at a computer show, the BIOS let you handle up to 160. I had something like 120 gigabyte in it, and you could move the partition around. I don't know what it'll let you do once it's established.
Anybody else?
I had Partition Magic years ago and was using it, and yes, you could expand an existing partition, you could split it up, you could do all sorts of things. You'd make 7 partitions as long as you had space, and you could combine them back again as long as they were adjacent.
Yes, but why would you want to do it?
Right. So have we beaten this horse enough for you?
Okay, well, well, let's change the question. Assuming I upgrade to Windows 7 and I want to optimize one for something, can I dual boot Windows 7?
I would think so, but again, any applications you have are only going to be visible in one or the other partition unless you install them in, you know, twice.
Comment.
Go ahead, comment.
Again, if we go to the boot INI file, the boot INI file can give you different ways that the operating system will come up. So you can come up in command mode only, or you can come up in a strip down without the network, or you can come up with, you know, however many different ways that you want to cut it. It's still the same operating system. It just cuts off certain functionality. And that's great if you're doing troubleshooting. It's great if you're trying to do support. Again, why, you know, why do you want to do it? And yes, you could probably install multiple versions of the software. Again, from a support perspective, that's very important. Again, it would have to be on separate partitions, and as Gordon mentioned and I said before, you'd have to reinstall your application software into each of those partitions. So it comes back to what it's being used for and why. Back to Net.
Let me expand on my ears. Thanks, Rachel. Consider this. If the software costs you money, you need to pay for it twice in most cases. Think about that, too. Okay. So with that in mind, you know, the boot INI file can be used to create a custom environment for, shall we say, high-performance applications, and, you know, if you want, versus ones that are, shall we say, more multiprocessor oriented or multiprocessing oriented. You have multiple applications you really want to run. My honest opinion is upgrade to Windows 7, get that all neat and pretty, and let Windows 7 be the environment in which you start managing your way through you know, your performance requirements. And I would do it with a single partition. Personally, if something is that important to have a second boot environment, it's important enough to have a second machine. I realize that's not always economically feasible, but ultimately that's the right answer. I just tear my head out, or tear my hair out when I hear people with multi-boot processors. And I get, now I'm going to exclude the Apple crowd from that because they have their own peculiar requirements. And I'll let NS2K go unbeaten up on this subject of his Apple dependency. But, you know, I understand why people have that affinity for the Apple environment. But, you know, not that the Windows is so wonderful either, but, you know, it's just a different way of looking at it. And, you know, pick an environment and just make it sure it's solid, stable, and that you're fluent in its manipulation, you'll be happier. I mean, the multi-boot thing is kind of kooky in general. Mr. Noel?
Okay, well, it's thundering outside. And we beat this one to death. And so we
have. All right, well, I'm glad you brought it up, but you all learned a little bit about things. That was helpful. I mean, we all learned a little bit about boot INI and a few other things you can do. I have a couple of questions for the net. My first question is, at the Sussex Ham Fest, I bought one of those little BNC to binding post adapters. I actually bought a couple of them with the express intention of making a J-pull out of some wire and just either hanging it from a tree or or the like, or even using it horizontally if that's what I had to do. I was just wondering, if I can't get up straight the full height, is it reasonable above the matching section to then bend the all or part of the vertical longer element horizontally or at an angle away from the vertical? Is that something reasonable to do for a J-ball? And I realize it's going to shape the pattern. I'm going to guess it'll point the RF in the direction of where you point the top of the wire. But has anyone done that? And because I wanted to use these adapters as a quick, you know, with either twin lead or ladder line or window line, make a huge honking tall J-ball. You know, let's say 20 meters, 40 meters, something like that.
Mr. J.K.?
Mr. Don?
Well, the original NFED ZEP antenna was just about that. It was a quarter-wave matching section with a half-wave on the end of it, just like a J-pole, except it was HF. And you could figure it as the matching section would be vertical, let's say from the top of your antenna support down to your shack, and then the halfway section would be run out horizontally. And that's been around since the Zeppelin.
That's what I kind of thought.
Pretty good.
Anybody else have any comments or questions? Okay. My next comment is, or what kind of wire is robust enough to handle that kind of environment? Any thoughts on that?
I think any kind of wire, it depends on how long it's going to take. Gordon, I could say any kind of wire that's strong enough.
Yeah, okay. I may actually have something even a little more bizarre in that I have the quarter wave section vertical and the half wave section essentially sloping downward, but we'll find that out when I get to it. But for field environments, I think I can do a 40 meter vertical on a J-pole, which I think would be outstanding. And no radials. So that should be interesting too. If I introduce radials underneath it, what will happen?
JK.
Don?
Yeah, when you think about it, in a sense, you're feeding the matching section with coax at some point near the end of the matching section, and then you're running that to your halfway wire. And if you had just a halfway vertical of, say, 66 feet of vertical wire or a sloping piece of wire, and you had that matching section, it would be the same as having an antenna going right at the base that match your IMPs to the coax. Either way, you're not... With a half-wave antenna, you don't really need a lot of radials, just a little bit, one or two maybe, and not even that maybe, depending on the ground connectivity. And 2CX read some stuff in the American QRP corporate website if you want to look that up.
Yeah, I'd be interested in essentially a J-pole or a vertical NFED ZEP without radials or with radials. I'd be very curious as to what they said about it and how that changes the radiation and, frankly, the match, if at all. It may not change the match much, but I'm kind of curious if it improves the radiation resistance a little bit, lowers it a bit. Alrighty. My other question is, this deals with antique and or current, but shall we say, in need of some cleaning kind of brass key elements. I have a couple of SpeedX keys that are brass, and they are brass. They are, you know, the color of brass. They're not brushed chrome or anything like that. And I was wondering what people have used to clean them up, what people have used to clean up the crinkle finish, if you have a black crinkle finish on the base, and what procedures should be followed with that, and is it even advisable to do that? I mean, beyond the context, because they're fully operational and everything, but I'm just wondering if you devalue them by people cleaning them excessively, you know, polishing them up. That was my first question. Then I have a second part of that question is I have a Vibroflex pair, a Vibroflex paddle my wife got for me a few Christmases ago, and I was kind of wondering as to whether I needed to clean that as well, because it's starting to look kind of like some of the stuff that I have that's 50, 60 years old. You know, it's had a few years on it, and it's no longer bright and shiny. And I remember when it was as bright and shiny and brass as the Chrome Speedex key that I have is now, along with its brass ferrules. So just try to get the temperature on process, procedure, and advisability of cleaning brass key and paddle elements. ETBAR.
Comment on that?
Is that out?
You want to clean brass and copper and just make it nice and bright without doing a lot of work on it and removing material, you know, with sandpaper and steel wool. Just use a little bit of oxalic acid. Oxalic acid is a weak acid. It's a reducing agent, as most acids are, and it will do it. It's quite often used for bleaching floors, wood floors, which have been stained mostly by rust stains from radiators and things like that. And if you go to a hardware store and ask for it, they usually will have it because it's used as a bleaching agent for wood. Teaspoon and a quart of water, and if you want to see how effective it is, throw in a penny or two, and it will remove all of the oxide, and it will also, from ferrous materials, remove the rust, because, again, it'll convert the rust back into iron again. So it's a good thing to try for cleaning that. The rest of the stuff, just clean it and use some silicone. Over it, just a thing, but you know, like for a wrinkle finish, a black painted wrinkle finish, just clean it with some detergent and water, and then spray it with silicone.
Black silicone?
A silicone spray, you know, you just wipe it on. It'll just put a shine to it.
Oh, I gotcha. In other words, don't color at all. Just leave it in whatever condition it's in. That makes sense. All right. I'm hearing fender boomers close to my house now, so I think I want to terminate this exercise. But does anybody else have anything for the net?
Yes.
What's
your doc? I think I just had W1CP's little website on the other day, and he's got there's a section in there on cleaning and restoring keys if you want to take a look at that, too. It's a few. I mean, some of these keys, I mean, obviously something goes to been made right before the Civil War. I don't think you'd want to mess with it any more than you want to take an old revolver from that vintage and pop it and change its appearance so it looks better than new. Some of these guys can do that, but you want to. And it all depends on your, what you want to do with the key. I'll leave it with that.
Good advice, Don. Very good advice. All right. Jim, you have me thinking about one thing, and that is, does that mean that if I have some rust marks on, shall we say, my beat-up old van, that a little bit of oxalic acid is not a bad thing to convert the rust back to iron?
Well, it'll do that, but it'll be powdered iron. It's not going to put a smooth surface back on again. I don't know if you remember seeing with the Barra banner. Someone stowed the Barra banner with some iron objects which rusted and severely stained the Barra banner. And
people were going to buy a new one, and I said, let me have it. And what I did is I made up a mild solution of the reducing agent oxalic acid, and the iron stains floated right off. I've done it on people's clothing and things like that. Yeah, get some. It's great for cleaning. You know, you want to clean something that's oxidized before you solder it, just dip it in this stuff. You can buy it for a couple of bucks at a hardware store. O-X-A-L-I-C, oxalic. And it's a weak acid, won't bother you, although I wouldn't put it in my eye.
All right, guys, I'm pulling connectors off the back of radios at this point. Getting a little nervous, so I think it's time to party somewhere else, as it were. Anyway, thank you for a wonderful night, and my next button is going to be to pull the power cable. So 7-3 and have a good one. This is K2BA, you're off and clear. Night-night.
Connected KD2AKP.
K2ZO, WEP2WPQ.
Connected J-O-4-D-L-N. J-O-4-D-L-N. Disconnected. KD2AKP. Disconnected. W2TTT. Disconnected.
W-8-2 Foxtrot check. Andrew, are you listening? This is Kilo, Kilo, 4 Foxtrot Echo.
Friday, Spartanburg, South Carolina. Over, over.
Thank you. Thank you.